All right, here we go. Monday morning after a Saints loss, but keep in mind they're still 2-1, tied for the top of the division, right? So everybody just relax, take a breath. It's a long, long season. Let me tell you about the weather. First of all, a 20% chance for showers today, highs in 90, same all the way through the week, really. Maybe a north breeze, not as humid on Thursday and Friday, and that storm that is in the Caribbean is expected to go toward the Florida Panhandle. No problem for us, but we'll continue to watch it. Mike Dettelier joins us now. Talk about the Saints game yesterday. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Tommy.
You know, Mike's going to be second-guessing this evening at the Silver Slipper on the beach in Hancock County, Mississippi, so we appreciate him getting up early, as we always do. Man, Mike, you talked about in the pregame, these Georgia guys, Jalen Carter, Jordan Davis, those are some studs, huh?
Well, Jalen Carter, man, when he wants to, I know their defensive line coach at Georgia, and he's worked with Pete Jenkins sort of in the offseason. When Jalen wants to play, he can be a dominant guy. He really can. And he came to play yesterday. The big surprise was Jordan Davis for me. Jordan hadn't done squat, nothing, with the Eagles. Took a lot of criticism about it, and they had difficulties stopping the run first couple weeks of the season. And I think Big Fangio really got on them pretty good. And Jordan came to play yesterday, and he took full advantage. Once Eric McCoy went down to the injury with the groin injury, he took full advantage of that. And both came to play. Now, you don't see that every week from them, but they did come to play hard yesterday.
I think yesterday's game was a tale of two centers, really. I know they had a lot more going on behind that, besides it. Rather, but if you look at the way Cam Jurgens played in place of Kelsey, and if you look at what happened after McCoy went out, not the same team at all, the Saints offensively. And look, I tweeted this yesterday because you told me this, that Buddy D told you this, or something with the Gamblers or something. Tell me the story about the starting center.
Yeah, this goes back to 19. I got asked about it about a dozen times yesterday.
Did you?
This goes back to probably 1994. I know it's 94. The goal sheet, Mort Olson put out the goal sheet for so many years. He did an extensive study on if you lose a center in the first quarter of a game or early in a game, and you lose a center, and he doesn't get to play the following week. At that time, it was like 76% of the time that you don't cover. And so Buddy didn't see the article, but I had gotten the goal sheet. And when I showed it to him, he was like, come on, there's no other bet that we could win on 76% of the shots. So that particular week, they had two NFL games and one college game that they had lost their center. So, but he was like, man, I'm gonna test it. Sure enough, hit on all three. That was it after that. He swore by it. 10 years later, 2004, the goal sheet went back and took a 10-year study on it. From there on, it was like 77%. Crazy thing is, in 2014, Buddy passed away in 2005. Mm-hmm. In 2014, the goal sheet did another study. In that 10, it was like 79.5% of the time. Man, he always used to say, if I had more self-restraint as a gambler, I'd be building my second house in Maui with the money I would have made. But it goes back to the goal sheet, doing that study. And, man, listen, he bet that every time he could, and it was really something. And you saw it yesterday.
I didn't sit down from the time McCoy went out. I did not sit down the entire game ever since he went out.
People have no idea, unless you played it or study it, how much that center. He's the time clock. That's a Kevin Mawai line, who's in Pro Football's Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. He's like, you're the time clock. You're the guy that makes everything run up front. You're telling the other four guys what to do. You're changing protection schemes. You're helping the guards out. One time it might be the left guard. The other time it might be the right guard. And if one of the things Kevin brought up this summer was with so many young quarterbacks, you got to calm them down sometimes. A lot of times used to be you would sit for 2 or 3 years before you played. Now they want the rookie quarterback to play. And he said you got to calm them down. And I think other than the quarterback spot, it's the most difficult spot to play.
We got to take a break, Mike. Saquon Barkley had 147 yards on the ground yesterday. I'll tell you, if you go back and look at that tape, a lot of it started with
Juergens
number
50. Made the block.
A lot of it started with number 51 for the Eagles. That's exactly right. You can take a look at it and you can see. All right, 6:20, we'll take a break, pick it up, we come back. Got any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. It was a frustrating game in a lot of different ways. We'll continue the conversation with Mike Dettelier when we come back. Time for traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Dettelier, who will be second-guessing this evening with Bobby Hebert. On location, Silver Slipper Casino, beautiful Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. They're going to size up the Saints-Eagles game, recap LSU, UCLA, then at 6:30, Saints Coaches Show with Mike Haas, Bobby Hebert, and D.A. At 7 o'clock, tight ends coach Clancy Barone, then Monday Night Football, doubleheader, Commanders. Well, no, just the second game, I guess. Commanders at Bengals, the two LSU Heisman Trophy winners, Jaden Daniels and Joe Burrow, taking on each other, and the other teams, of course, WWLAMFM.com and the Odyssey app. Mike, speaking of, I don't know where I got this from, speaking of, but Dallas Goedert, 6'5", 256. Man, it's kind of hard to lose track of a guy that big, isn't it? And I understand on the last big catch, three guys ran into each other. And previously, in the first half, we had two guards pulling into each other, which is not good. All in all, not a good day for the Saints, offensively, defensively, and even special teams. You had the doink, but it went through. The punter punted more. At least we found out what Matthew Hayball can do in a game, right? Tell me what your thoughts are on the overall team performance yesterday.
They had difficulties covering the tight end last year, and we hadn't seen it much in the first two games, but boy, did it show big yesterday. And they kept throwing the ball to Dallas because of the fact A.J. Brown was not in the lineup, so they needed someone to take up the slack of Devontae Smith, is certainly a tremendous receiver. He got hurt during the game. And Goddard became their go-to guy when they needed something. Man, he wasn't a little open, Tommy. He was wide open.
And look, I get on that last play that three guys ran into each other, but that's got nothing to do with the catches that he had. Targeted 11 times, 10 receptions for 170 yards. That didn't all come on that last play.
No, and he's a good player, but if I'm him, I'm putting that on the highlight reel if I'm negotiating a new contract. Because of that, I think really the Saints lost the game up front. The Eagles were the much more physical team in the trenches. And I think that's where they won it. The Saints did try to run the ball. I'm leaving yesterday going to my vehicle after the game, and somebody was like, they didn't try to run the ball. They ran the ball 29 times yesterday. It's just that it didn't look right, and it didn't look right once McCoy left.
Nope.
You got to think about this. When you start moving pieces along the offensive line, like Lucas Patrick gets moved from left guard to center, then you got to put in the new left guard. It didn't affect one position. It affected two, and you didn't run as well. I thought that was much more pressure coming from inside with Carter. And so –
Davis.
You had a difficult day. I thought overall you got a good pass rush on Jalen Hurts, and he didn't have as huge an impact as we've seen in the past running the ball. But they spent a lot of money in the offseason for Saquon Barkley. They got their money's worth yesterday.
Well, that's what made
I thought
so...
he had a really good game.
That's what made it so frustrating. Okay, so you win a turnover battle, you plus one in turnovers, you block a punt. You hold them the 15 points. The defense, Carl Granderson, came to play. Pete Werner had a pretty good game. Some other players had good games as well, until they didn't. right? And then you give up, you get gashed for those big plays. Offensively, you had some moments of brilliance, but it all changed when the center went out, and I don't know what happens next week, but we'll pick it up here, talk about it when we come back.
And to think about it, Atlanta's lost their center. We don't know for how long. It affected that game last night with the Falcons.
I did not see it. I went to bed. When did that happen?
In the second quarter, Dolman went down with an injury, and their right tackle, McGrady, also went down. So the question mark for both teams next week, now I don't have a percentage on that one, if you're playing without your two starting centers.
Wow. All right. That's going to change it. We'll take a break. Boy, that McGrady, he's a man among men, huh? That's a big son of a gun.
He's a big dude.
When you see 6'6", 306, when you see somebody standing out on the offensive line among other offensive linemen as being big, you know that's a big guy. 6:30 more. We come back. Time now, WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mike Dettelier, who'll be second-guessing from the Silva Slipper Casino in beautiful Hancock County, Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, later on this evening. Mike, let's talk about the center, and everything changed when Eric McCoy went out. We don't know, and we're not going to know. And then you talked about the Atlanta center being out. Let's talk about, because I think you did you not do a study or something, or some kind of research about the offensive linemen being the most injured position and depth and all of that?
Yeah, I did it a couple years back, and it's clear-cut offensive linemen, centers, guard tackles. It's 1, 2, 3. They get hurt more than any other position out on the field. The problem today in the NFL is the lack of quality depth at any one of those three positions. So that really spotlights what you have up front along the offensive line. So, yeah, the tackles, it went tackles, guard, centers, 1, 2, 3. They're the most injured players on the football field at the pro and college level.
Where do the Saints go from here? And I guess it all depends on what happens with Eric McCoy and how badly he's hurt, which we don't know. And if I don't know who's available, who's out there. If you need somebody, tell me about depth.
Yeah, well, it goes to show you and I get why coaches and players say next man up, but it goes to show you that that's not reality in life. So if I'd have told you before the season started the Saints would be 2-1 after three games, you'd have taken it.
Yep.
In a heartbeat.
Yep.
In a heartbeat. And so you got to move on. And again, with Atlanta, you understand they're looking in the same mirror. They've got problems up front along their offensive line. And they played a very emotional and a tough game last night against Kansas City. Kansas City can't run the football at all. And they had difficulties last night with it, too. So your concentration now flips, to the Falcons. These games have all been, no matter what the record is, strange. Strange occurrences happen when the Saints play the Falcons, but you got to flip it. And they're a different team today because of Kirk Cousins. And Kirk's a real accurate quarterback, and he's had some big games against the Saints. The one thing I see in the post-Achilles injury that he had is, he was never really a movement guy to begin with, but he doesn't move well at all. So you got to stop the run with them because that's their bread and butter on offense. They want to run the football, and they want to kind of beat you up, play a little bully ball with you. And that is becoming a little bit more part of the game where we got away from running the football to a certain extent. Now it's back in because of the fact these two high safety play, man, you almost need binoculars to find the safeties today. Mm-hmm. But if you can run the football, they got to come in. And then that's when you can hit the deep throw. But injuries are a part of the game. You have to adjust to it because it is going to happen. It's not a question of if, but when. And so they got to take care of business against the Falcons and understanding this is a 2-for-1 game. because it's an NFC South opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So they fighting the same issues you are at this stage. And they found out late in the game, and you don't want to have Mahomes with the football in his hands.
And then the Saints got the Chiefs coming up after that, which, again, it's a big deal. They're the Super Bowl champion. I get that, but they're an AFC team, and you got to keep your eye on the ball, right, and the prize and the division games. And, like, you're talking about a two-for-one deal, and that's where Dennis Allen and the rest of the staff comes in, keeping the team focused.
Yeah, another thing, too, is what you're looking at, Dennis has had difficulty in the month of October, November.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Sean Payton's teams really were good. I remember the last 3 years with Sean. He was 10-1 in the month of October. And I think it's 7-5 in the month of November. That last year he was here, I think he lost three straight. In November, the record would have been better than that. Dennis Allen has losing records in October and November. That's when normally you're starting to piece all this together as a football team, to hit that stride. And that's something he has talked about, that I'm cognizant that we should be getting better in that month of in the months of October and November as a team overall, and we hadn't got the job done the last couple years in those crucial months.
Somebody texted in and said Jason Kelce is free. I like that. That's not a bad idea. I don't think he's coming back, though. 651, 9 till 7, more when we do come back with Mike Dettelier. Right now, traffic, WWL. All right, 655, 5 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mike Dettelier. Mike, I see Chris Novinsky, who did a lot of the concussion research as it relates to NFL players, tweeted about DeVonta Smith being hit by Christian Boyd, and I saw that yesterday, and I hope the young man's okay, but you talk about all the king's horses and all the king's men. Physics of this, you got 370, I think it is, was Christian Boyd weigh?
He's 335 plus.
Okay, 335 plus, running into 170 pounds. And I hope he's okay. You know, you never want to see anybody hurt, and especially, you know, you got DeVonta Smith, got his whole career ahead of him, a Heisman Trophy winner from a meet. You think there's going to be a penalty, a fine about that coming in?
Yes, I think. The way the NFL is today, you know, 10 years ago, probably, he didn't, you know, it's just a regular play.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the way they are about head, brain injuries, concussion, yeah. Most likely he'll get a fine for it. That's just the way it is in the league today. You don't get a penalty. They go back and take a look at it. You get fined for it.
My first thought was, and I did hear Deuce say, I think that they got to blow the whistle on that maybe a little bit earlier. I don't know if they do or not. But my first thought was the sheer physics of 320 hitting 170. That can't be a good thing. I can't
make
the result at all. Because we're talking about
how thin Devontae, all his life, he's always, you know, he's a thin kind of build receiver. He is as a sophomore, came to our pro football camp in Thibodaux. He got on the scale; he was 148 pounds. Mm. And somebody told me, Mike, I had not seen him before, and it was like, watch him. Now Justin Jefferson, Ja'Marr Chase were at the same camp, and they were like, watch that guy. First time he ran a route, he corkscrewed a guy into the ground, almost had to get a shovel to get him out. I mean, he absolutely corkscrewed him. And he just had the biggest smile. He's a tremendous competitor for a thin guy. We saw what he did at Alabama, won the Heisman Trophy, first-round pick. And he's a really good football player. But you're right. The physics of this, of a 170-pound man going up against a 330-pound guy and getting hit, and you straight up, because the guy's holding him, and you're getting hit, and you're going to take some shots.
It's
that
like
is a, part like, of football today.
Like a train running into you is what it was like, because he was without the ability to protect himself, and it was just like being, I thought of somebody being, you know how these sickos push people on a subway tracks in New York? That's what it looked like to me, where it's like, holy moly. Real quick, I don't think you have to be an expert to know that this Atlanta Falcons Saints game is probably going to come down to a field goal?
Yeah, I would think. I mean, It didn't at the end of last year. That was, you know, a blowout win for the Saints. But normally, there's some strange things that happen when the Saints play Atlanta. And I can't explain why. And it doesn't matter what the record is for either club, but special teams played a part. And Tommy, I don't get where this is coming from, but twice yesterday, Nick Sirianni passes up.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Makeable field goals.
He's got an interesting field goal philosophy and then goes for a 60-yarder.
60-yard. Okay, kid, get out there and kick the 60. What? You passed me up on a couple of them that were makeable, and then the Saints did the exact same thing Dennis Allen did. Now, I get it from time to time, and it just depends on the type of game. But this was a low-scoring game where points were premium. Man, had the Eagles lost that game, that's all you'd have heard fairly about what kind of idiot Sirianni was to pass up points and then tell your kicker, go out there and kick the 60-yarder. But it is part of the NFL today where the 50-yard-plus field goal has become routine. But you're going to pass up the 40-something-yard field goals? I don't get that in a low-scoring game. Why are you passing up points?
Crazy. Thank you, Mike. We'll listen this afternoon as your second guest with Bobby Hebert from the Silver Slipper Casino. Jeff Palermo next, talking LSU. 7:15, hot. You heard the thing in the news about El Nino, La Nina, whatever the hell it is. I get them confused, but they're talking about a warmer autumn than normal, which is not happy for me. I was out yesterday cutting grass after the Saints game, and it looked like fall, but it certainly did not feel like fall. Highs near 90 all the way through the week. Maybe a little bit cooler by the weekend and lower humidity, and then they got that tropical system that they're watching. But all in all, no cold fronts on the way, but we still got some time. September 23rd, first full day of autumn today. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
Pretty good. You know, I was talking about the weather, and I texted somebody at halftime of the LSU game and said, LSU's going to be okay. The offensive line, the heat and humidity will wear UCLA down. And it pretty much did, didn't it?
I think it wore everyone down, to be honest with you. I mean,
70-something people treated for heat? Did I see that right?
Yeah, it was 70-plus. And who knows? That's kind of an unofficial number. That number may have grown as the game went on. I know Tulane and UL Lafayette had a very similar situation where they were playing at 11 a.m. over in Lafayette. So just unfortunately, TV, you know, they schedule these games, and they don't really take into the fans' account of what it might be like that day. But as far as wearing down UCLA, I'm sure the heat had a part of that. I just think it was better execution for LSU in the second half. I mean, Brian Kelly would tell you that, especially on defense. They just executed better. What he called the mistakes that they made in the first half, just very maddening. There's just too much of guys trying to do too much in a way. Trying to make up maybe for somebody else that's not necessarily executing their job perfectly, so they're trying to do two things at once. And what Brian Kelly is trying to stress to these guys is, hey, just worry about your job, and it will all take care of it yourself. If you execute your job, it will prevent some of these. Now, they didn't give up the big 60-plus plays, 60-plus yard plays in this game, but they still allowed UCLA to have two drives that took 75 yards and scored a touchdown. And this was a very anemic offense through the first 2 weeks of the season.
Saw it all over the NFL yesterday with people, you know, changing at the last minute or trying to figure out on defense what we're going to do here or there. Just do what you're supposed to do. That's all you got to do, right?
Right. Yeah, that was the message at halftime, and I think it resonated. I still have questions about this defense, and those questions become even bigger with the news that finally broke yesterday and what we kind of feared at the end of the game, that Harold Perkins, the star linebacker for LSU, out for the year with a torn ACL. That's now two big-time players on LSU's defense that are lost for the season. Jacoby and Guillory, of course, tore his Achilles tendon, and now you got Harold Perkins out. And, you know, some people will look at Harold Perkins' stats this year and say, well, it's not all that productive. He hasn't done a lot. But what he does do is other offenses have to account for him. You have to be watching where he's at. And if you're in a passing situation, you've got to make sure he's blocked or he's gonna do some harm to your to the quarterback. And it's opened it up for guys like Braden Swenson, who has been absolutely fantastic here the last 2 weeks, really the whole season, and Savion Jones. But Braden Swenson's got 5 sacks over the last 2 games. And a lot of it is because he's being blocked one-on-one. Well, now that Harold Perkins is out for the year, that changes. Teams are going to account for Braden Swenson. They're going to make sure that guy is not getting into the backfield as easily as he's been. So it's a big loss. It's a big loss for a defense that is still just trying to find its way. And if you started the season, Tommy, and you were talking to me about, hey, who are 2 guys that LSU could ill afford to lose on defense, the top 2 names on that would be Jacobian Guillory and Harold Perkins. And both of them are gone a quarter into the season, a third into the season.
And mounting up on the injuries mounting up, you got, don't forget about John Emery with the ACL as well on the offensive side.
That's
of the
true.
Ball.
Yep.
Let me take a break. Exactly. We'll pick it up. Exactly. And look, some people were giving some fans a hard time for leaving the game, whatever. But, man, when you sit on that sideline with that sun baking you, it's easy when you're sitting in your air-conditioned TV to criticize, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Not that the TV is air conditioning. Your room is air conditioning. You know what I'm saying?
It's tough. I mean, anybody that was just kind of walking around, if you went to the grocery store that day and you walked from your car into the grocery store from the parking lot, you were saying, "Man, it's hot out here." Imagine just sitting there and baking for 2 hours.
And LSU was playing in it as well with the dark jerseys, which I guess that's what they wanted to do. But maybe they need to look at these 2:30 games in the South. I don't know. We'll talk about that. I know Brian Kelly was asked about it at the press conference. We'll continue the conversation with Jeff Palermo when we come back. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. Talk about Garrett Nussmeier and more when we return. 7:21. Oh, if you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Oakenheart Jeweler talk and text line. I'll pass them along. We come back. Traffic now, WWL. Hi, 7:25. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. Jeff, last week you wrote about Aaron Anderson, and he did come up big for the Tigers on Saturday. Talk about that a little bit, if you will, please.
Well, he's really been a guy that's emerged this season, a breakout guy. This was a kid, a 5-star prospect out of Edna Carr. When he came out of the, I think it was the 2022 recruiting class, he was considered the top player in the state, top wide receiver in the state, ended up going to Alabama, didn't play that season there, came to LSU, or didn't barely play it anyways, and then came to LSU last year. And, well, you know what, LSU had 2 first-round draft picks at wide receiver, and Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas Jr., and Kyron Lacy was pretty good, and Chris Hilton was kind of your speed guy. So there just really wasn't an opportunity for him to get a lot of opportunities. Well, fast forward to this season, it kind of looked like at the beginning of the season, again, he would be a little bit lost in the shuffle because ahead of him on the depth chart, you had guys like Xavion Thomas, Chris Hilton again, Kyron Lacy, and then C.J. Daniels they brought in from Liberty. But Chris Hilton gets hurt in preseason camp. It opens up an opportunity for Aaron Anderson, and he's delivered. He's been that big play type of receiver, and LSU is – been throwing for a bunch of yards this season. I think Garrett Nussmeier leads the Southeastern Conference in passing yards, but they really haven't hit on a lot of big plays. But the times that they have hit on, 30, 40-yard pass plays, it's been Aaron Anderson. So just kind of great to see when a kid just kind of keeps going at it, doesn't get the success that you think he's going to get when he first enters college. But eventually, if you keep working at it, he'll break through. And what Brian Kelly said, it's just not what he's doing on the football field. It's everything. It's the academics. It's his personal life. It's him growing up as a man. And that's what sometimes happens in college football. Some of these kids just, when they come and they want to, they just worry about success only on the field, not everywhere else in life. And sometimes you got to get those other components of your life headed in the right direction, and then you'll also see results on the field, and that's what's happening here for Aaron Anderson.
Talk about the offensive line, LSU. Preseason expectations and performance.
I think what was a bit encouraging, LSU had a very long drive in that game against UCLA where they went 90-plus yards, and it was really the first time that we've seen this year when they were running the football that they were actually getting pushed. They were getting a bit of a push and they were knocking UCLA back a little bit. And that was when Josh Williams had a really nice series, and he finished it off scoring a touchdown. And that was really nice to see. It was really the first time that they were able to consistently do that. Emory Jones went down with an ankle injury during the game. Tyree Adams came in and replaced him. Emory Jones did come back later in the game. But you kind of wonder, with South Alabama coming up this Saturday and then a bye week and then Ole Miss, you wonder if they'll push it with Emory Jones this week. But I thought it was a step in the right direction for LSU offensively on the offensive line. And then no sacks, too. Nussmeier, after getting harassed by South Carolina the week before, he was upright for most of the game against the Bruins. So I think it was a positive step. Granted, that UCLA defensive line, not as tough as what LSU faced in South Carolina. That was a pretty good defensive line, and they got after it and really made it a long day for Garrett Nussmeier in the offense.
Garrett Nussmeier can spin it for people. Has he rushed at all yet? Has he?
Well, he hasn't ran it that much, and he really, there was really just one game this season where he faced a lot of pressure, and that was South Carolina. And those edge rushers for South Carolina were coming at him so fast, he didn't have really a chance to react and run like a Jaden Daniels could.
What I was wondering is where he pulls it and keeps it. I'm thinking maybe we're saving that for Ole Miss or something. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe.
Because it seems like it's wide open. It's just wide open, and it seems like maybe they're holding that in their pocket.
Well, maybe, but he's also got some terrific wide receivers to go to. Mm-hmm. I mean, we mentioned Aaron Anderson. How about Mason Taylor? Big game for Mason Taylor against UCLA. Kyren Lacy dropped a couple passes. First time he's dropped passes this year, but he's still been a wide receiver one. C.J. Daniels has been good. They're going to try to get Chris Hilton in the mix here. He's got a lot of weapons to go to, and I know Jaden did too last year, but Jaden had just it was freakish how good he was.
Get to see him tonight take on Joe Burrow, who has the best of each of it. I know it's a team sport, but of the two Heisman quarterbacks from LSU tonight, Jaden Daniels, Joe Burrow, who you think comes out ahead?
I think this is a big game for the Bengals. I'm expecting Burrow and the Bengals to have the better game here tonight against the Commanders.
Just wanted to pick your brain. Thank you, Jeff. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, Tommy. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. When we come back, we'll take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street, Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Monday morning. You know what that means? Time to take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street, Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO, Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. How you doing, Mark?
Tommy, how are you? Happy Monday to you.
Well, happy Monday to you, too. I got bad news for you because I don't know if it's La Nina, whatever the hell it is, but they're talking about a warm fall, and you and I have a standing appointment at Fogo de Chao. Is that how you say it?
Yes,
to eat 58 pounds of beef each when first day. Yes, the first each again.
But it's got to be cool.
An aggregate of over 100 pounds. The minimum is 100 pounds between the two of us, but it's got to be cool to do that. It's not going to turn cool. But enough of that.
That's it. This is very discouraging.
They'll keep it in the refrigerator. They'll keep the beef in the refrigerator. It'll be there, and we'll go and eat 100 pounds of beef. Tell me what's going on Wall Street and the market and interest rates and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, everybody, of course, it was just such an anticipated event that when is the Fed going to lower and all the conversation that comes with it. And, again, the last time they raised was July of 23, and then the first time they lowered was just within this month. And the Dow has done wonderfully well. It broke 42,000, set more records, finished at 42,400 and change. And I think the market is just giddy about what the Fed is doing. And we just can't lose sight of the fact that if they're starting to embark on a series of interest rate reductions, they're doing it for a reason. It is the economy slowing, and we've seen evidence of that. We've seen it through the labor market. The next report is out next Friday. We've seen it in some retail sales in some cases, a lot of industrial production that has gone down. We've seen, it's the economy's taken those hits. So I think that's what, since they lowered by half a point, there's been so much conversation and analysis around that, and it's like it immediately turns to a conversation of, okay, what have you done for me lately? What's next? So the Fed meets in 45 days, and that sounds like broken records, but that's what's going to happen in November the 7th. And right now, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Fed predictor is all the analysts apparently split at this point. Of course, it could change any time. Half of them, right at 50%, expect another 50 basis point cut, and the other 50% say, no, they probably started out with a bang, and they're going to get down to a more normal level. Normal for them is 25 basis points. But, I mean, just from before they even cut, the HELOC demand, home equity credit lines, have gone crazy. People are refinancing those and taking those out because we've had such progress in mortgage lending rates. You know, so just August a year ago, it hit a high 8.25% in some cases, which was, you start tearing up when you see rates like that on big ticket items, on mortgages. That's one thing if you had a car loan that's going to end in 4 years. That's the other thing if it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that you got cooking for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And this folds into what we were saying on Friday with the other segment, but looked at bank rate. You and I were talking about 5.1% fixed 30-year mortgages available now. So if any of our listeners, if you missed Friday, go to bankrate.com. They got a bunch of buttons there. You could click, home mortgage, but you'll see some variable rates. You'll see, more importantly, some fixed rates that start with the 5. And they're almost low enough to start with the 4 in the case of the 5.1s. But and also, I mean, just to say, as far as Jefferson Financial's website, go on there and look at the calculators, look at mortgage refinances, look at mortgage financing, look at all those things, and you could put in the various rates. If you're trying to get out of something too high, or if you've been waiting very patiently to finally go and pull trigger on a mortgage or sell your house, buy something else or whatever, it's really been accommodating. But it's, it's like, what is the Dow doing? I think it's right now in the middle of a couple of things. That it's going to trend sideways this week because there's really no fantastic economic news to move it, I think, significantly. We're in between rate changes with respect to FedWatch, and we're about a week or so away from when the corporate earnings start coming out. So that'll be the first week of October. So right now, I guess the Dow is going to sit, I would anticipate it's going to sit around the 42,000 mark and not do much. But I'm thinking that a lot of people within the sound of our voice are cheering on what their 401k has been doing because the markets have been rallying.
So you're talking about triggering, and a lot of this information can trigger me emotionally. But let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back.
Absolutely.
Because when do you pull a trigger on refinancing, and how do you decide when to pull a trigger if you are, and we always have this conversation, but timing's everything, with the 401k,
sure.
And if you're thinking, okay, well, I want to get the profits out of it, I want to get the gains of it, that money's real right now, right? That could be a new car.
Very
I'm talking
real.
About. That could be this, that could be that, the other thing.
That's right.
If I wait a couple of months, guess what? It might not be there anymore. So we'll pick that up when we come back. If y'all have any questions, 504-260-1870. Very valuable information, as always, from Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. You can go to jeffersonfinancial.org, find some very useful calculators. More on those when we come back. 751 Traffic Now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, talking about the interest rate cut by the Fed, what's likely to happen with that, what's likely to happen with Wall Street, the timing of either refinancing your home or buying a home or building a home. I don't know that you're ever going to time it perfectly. And also, Mark, on the other end of it, people with the 401ks and retirement accounts, the Wall Street's cooking, but it's a market, and that's not always going to continue to cook, right? So at what point do you say, okay, I'm going to take the gains and move on?
Oh, absolutely, and that's the hard part. While you're sitting here on record highs and your balance is high and you got a big smile on your face, mm-hmm. It's like, well, how do I, overcome all that emotion and say, I'm just going to take money off the table. And then it begs the question, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
That's what everybody tells me as far as, you know what I mean? Okay, I'm going to I'll sell out of this, and I'll sell out of that. So any further price appreciation and whatever you're selling out of, that's gone because you've limited it. And then what to do with the money? But as far as it seems like you've got an enormous amount of hedging here from legendary investor Warren Buffett. He's got a record amount of cash he's sitting on. And then money market funds have hit an all-time high at over $6 trillion. So apparently you got a lot of people collectively saying, I've pulled money out of the market because they don't have to. They could put it in. They could put it back in right now, and money market balances could be falling dramatically. It's not. They've been increasing. And Warren has been selling off bank stocks because a lot of people, you and I go back to that, you know, the conversation about this commercial real estate crisis that's looming.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are saying, look, I think it's going to develop into some type of banking crisis. So I don't want to be in the financial stocks. That's Warren Buffett saying that and raising cash. Like, he doesn't have any compelling investment to put cash towards. So, you know, I mean, we can't ignore those types of things because they're real, they're large, they're institutional investors, they're sophisticated money. And, you know, you don't want to be betting against that, so to speak. And it takes some courage to understand where your portfolio is.
Well, I got close to $500 sitting in that bank. I want to make sure that I do what's right with it. You know what I'm saying?
I hear that. No, that's right.
Thank you, Mark.
Be valuable. Careful with that kind of money.
Yes, well, I shouldn't even set it on the air. I shouldn't have even put that out there. Now I'm a kidnapping target.
Huh? Absolutely.
Now I'm like one of the Gettys. Now I got a target on my back, talking. Like one of the Gettys, you know what I'm saying, for a kidnapping. Thank you, Mark. Valuable information. Yes, have a great week, and we'll talk to you Friday when we help you manage your money with Mark. Taking a quick break, coming back. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us, WWL. All right, 8:15, just got off the line with Peyton Malone there, WWR Louisiana meteorologist, and bad news for our friends in Florida, and that storm that's in the Caribbean could be a Category 3, a major hurricane heading into the Florida Panhandle by Thursday, so we'll keep an eye on that. Christy Trail joins us now, Executive Director of Pontchartrain Conservancy, to talk about their 35th birthday this month and talk about what they've accomplished. Good morning, Christy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm great.
Tell me about the history of the Pontchartrain Conservancy, which, correct me if I'm wrong, started as the Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation and Save Our Lake. That's how people would remember it?
That's how people would remember it if you were around in 1989. So, yeah, it's exciting to be celebrating our 35th year this month. Actually, it was September 1989 when we were officially founded. So it's interesting to know that we share a birthday with Bruce Springsteen. Of course, he's 75 mm-hmm. or 35, but still exciting nonetheless.
But you were both born to run, weren't you?
You got that right.
Yes. and you're both celebrating glory days. So I can keep this up forever, being the Springsteen fan that I am.
Same.
What's your favorite Springsteen song, Christy Trail?
Oh, I like Born to Run. That's a good one.
I think Glory Days should be, if they were going to have a song of the, you know, millennium when it turned back way back when the 2000, whatever the hell it was, 2001, I think that should have been the song of the millennium, because I think that is just a snapshot, a motion picture of life. I really do.
It's a fun one. It's a fun one to get up and dance to, for sure.
Well, it just you know, it's like, yeah, I hope I don't. I hope when I get older, I don't sit back thinking about it, but I probably will, just like everybody else does. So let's talk about the glory days of the Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation, the now Pontchartrain Conservancy, which are still ahead of it. And here's the thing. You know, when it first started, you know, whenever you try to do anything from a conservation standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, there are going to be detractors. But yet, when you look back, years later, you can say, well, it's a good thing that we did that. And I think this is a classic example of that. Do you?
Absolutely. And I use that story quite a bit, because for any of your listeners that do remember the days when we started back in 1989, you know, Lake Pontchartrain was a polluted body of water. And a lot of that reason that it became that way was because of the clamshell dredging that was occurring at the time. And our organization came in 1989. That was our big rallying cry, very grassroots effort, Save Our Lake. And we worked really hard to ban clamshell dredging in the lake, partnering with businesses, with the state, with local governments, homeowners, residents, you name it. But it was not an easy fight. It was a big uphill battle. And, you know, at the time, people were just arguing, well, you can't be for the environment because then you're going to halt all the economic development. And you fast forward to today and you look at the fact that clamshell dredging is banned. Our economy is thriving as a result of having a clean lake. And in fact, you can have both. You can have the environment and you can have a healthy economy. So it's that story that we use and say, you know, don't you remember when we started or remember what it was a fight? But people are so thankful that we did it and that the lake is clean.
What was the catalyst? Was it a group of people that got together because of the condition of the lake and scientists like yourself, engineers that said this is all because of the clam dredging and that's where we need to stop?
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is just, you know, through time, the activity in the lake, really the, you know, demise of the ecology of the lake. It was some professors at UNO and Tulane, really, that got together, as you mentioned, based on science, wrote a report called To Save Lake Pontchartrain. And essentially, that report was our checklist to get started. And it was through those professors at UNO and Tulane and a lot of really strong community activists that carried that report around through the legislature saying, we need a group to do this. We need a group to do this. We need a neutral third party to come in and untangle all these regulations and get us started on this checklist. And that's how we started. Somebody advocated to pass a bill in the Louisiana legislature in 1989 to form a, you know, neutral entity that would take on this task of cleaning up Lake Pontchartrain. And what we did was grab that report from those professors, ground it in science, and got to work. And the first thing we did was work to ban the clamshell dredging because that was number one in their report.
You know, one thing I didn't realize, and you can pick it up when we come back, how the state was reaping money because of the clamshell dredging because it was classified as minerals, right?
That is correct. It was managed by the...
Go ahead and finish.
I was going to say it was managed by the Louisiana Mineral Board at the time, and you're correct. The state was collecting royalties off the dredging.
So we'll pick it up when we come back, because I think it is a cautionary tale maybe about the environment, or a successful tale about the environment, how, you know, you got to look to the future. You can't just look to the present, and how in this case it was, I don't know, we'll talk about the clams and what happened to the shells, et cetera, when we come back with Christie's Trail, Executive Director, Pontchartrain Conservancy, celebrating their 35th birthday this month. But is it the same birthday today, Christie, as Bruce Springsteen or not?
Not today. It was just a few days ago that our birthday was, but nonetheless, same month, so I'll take it.
Birthday month. There you go. All right, 821 traffic now, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Christie Trail, Executive Director of the Pontchartrain Conservancy. They share the same birthday month, as does the boss, Bruce Springsteen, who is celebrating his 75th birthday today, I believe it is. Christie, let's talk about these clams, if you will. And again, I think we can all learn about looking at the history of what was the Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation, the clam dredging in the lake, what was predicted would happen, the doom and gloom, and then the end result of it all, how the lake is clean now, there has been economic development, and what happened with the clam industry? I'm just curious.
Well, in Lake Pontchartrain, you can't dredge clamshells any longer. But, you know, I guess we could talk a little bit about kind of why. Why were we dredging those clamshells? And it goes back to a little bit of the history of the geology of Louisiana. As you know, we're built in an alluvial floodplain here in South Louisiana. All of this land was built by the Mississippi River. So in essence, you know, there's no bedrock when you're drilling down and trying to find a hard surface to build upon. And a lot of the areas throughout South Louisiana were drained and then built upon, but we don't have natural rock here in South Louisiana either. So, you know, the inventive people there in economic development turned to the resources that we do have, things such as oyster shells and clam shells. So the clams were dug up to mix with our soft soils to create things like roadbeds, roadways, and foundations for houses. So especially a lot of the houses that are built slab on grade in South Louisiana, those neighborhoods were built with mud and clamshells. And so that's what was really used for all that economic development, driving to get those clamshells out of the lake, because we needed that hard surface to mix with our soft soils. But we found other ways to do it, right? We've now turned to concrete, figured out other ways to build with pilings, driving those down to the sand layer. So knowing that we can do the same things without the clamshells, that has just still continued to thrive in our economy here. And the great news is the clams are back and they're doing their job. Their job is to clean water. That's what they do all day. So that now that they're back in the lake all throughout South Louisiana, they're keeping the water clean.
So that's what I wanted to get to. Not only did the dredging disrupt the pollution of the lake and the cloudy of the lake, but it left the clams alone, which are natural filtration devices, correct?
That's right. That's why we love the clams. They keep the lake clean so we can get out there and enjoy it.
All right. Y'all got a cleanup day coming or anything or not? What's coming up next for the Pontchartrain Conservancy?
Well, we have a big birthday celebration this Friday out at the New Canal Lighthouse. You can come celebrate like it's the 80s and watch Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and come see the clams. We've got a big display talking about the clams out there as well.
Sounds like fun. You can go to MississippiRiverDelta.org. How do you find out more about it?
Yes, MississippiRiverDelta.org is a coalition that we are part of, as well as our website, scienceforourcoast.org.
Thank you, Christy. Appreciate the time as always. We'll talk to Rafael Goyeneche when we come back. 8:30 time for traffic now. News, WWL. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this Monday morning, September 23rd. Rafael Goyeneche joins us now, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, to talk about murder in New Orleans dropping by 50%, going from the murder capital of the world to not. How you doing, Rafael? Good morning.
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about how and why this happened, and is it sustainable? Is it due to the NOLA coalition? Is it due to increased efforts when it comes to juvenile crime? Is it increased manpower with NOPD? Your thoughts?
Well, so what's been happening, I believe it absolutely is sustainable because we've seen this now play out over 2 years. And it really started in the last quarter of 2022, which was our high water violent crime rate in the past 30 years in the city. So what changed in that quarter was the police department went back to proactive policing, meaning that not waiting for someone to dial 911. Police officers are trained to observe and act upon their observations. And during COVID, the police department stopped narcotics enforcement, stopped traffic enforcement, stopped gun enforcement, and all they did was put their eggs in the responding to calls for service, which means that a crime was already committed. So in the last quarter of 2022, the police department started to double down on gun enforcement. We saw that particularly highlighted in the 8th District or the French Quarter. So officers were arresting people that they saw carrying weapons under their clothing. That gave them the justification to go up and approach them and ask them if they were carrying a concealed weapon. If the answer was yes, they could begin to make an arrest. And about 60% of those misdemeanor gun stops evolved in a felony arrest. So the people that were being arrested for felonies were people like convicted felons in possession of a firearm, a stolen firearm, a firearm that was fully automatic, and you start taking those people and those weapons off the street, we started to see crime go down. Now, in August of this year, constitutional carry became the law. Mm-hmm. So that means that the police can't so much rely upon their other strategy of looking for gun enforcement. So what they've done is they've doubled down on traffic stops and narcotics enforcement. So a lot of the traffic stops, just last Thursday, the state police made 42 traffic stops last Thursday. Mm-hmm. And that resulted in 6 arrests, but only 9 citations. So the traffic stops that they were making, if they found that the offender or the traffic violator didn't do anything serious, they let him go with a warning. But with those 42 stops, they made 6 arrests. They took 6 firearms, a bunch of drugs, convicted felon, stolen car, and that's what the police department is doing. So that's why we're starting to see crime go down and stay down because of precision, proactive policing. The police are looking for the offenders that are most impacting crime. And that's exactly what they're doing, and that's being reflected in the crime stats.
Was that Orleans Parish only?
Yes. That's Troop NOLA. That was Troop NOLA.
Troop NOLA. Okay, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Rafael Goyeneche, president of Metropolitan Crime Commission. I don't know how that factors into the consent decree or not. We'll talk about that and more when we come back. 850, 10 till 9, Traffic Now, WWL. 855, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission, talking about murders in New Orleans and dropping 50% and the effects of Troop NOLA. Rafael, how does that work out with the consent decree, and where do we stand on all of that with Troop NOLA, which is the Louisiana State Police, and NOPD? Compare and contrast.
So first off, the consent decree only involves the NOPD, not the Louisiana State Police.
Right.
But there's nothing in the consent decree that prohibits the state police or the NOPD from doing traffic enforcement, from doing narcotics enforcement, from doing proactive policing. So it's all about constitutional policing. And the consent decree, while it doesn't apply to the state police are also practicing constitutional policing. They're pulling people over for traffic violations that are legitimate. Keep in mind that their vehicles all have cameras in them. So there's going to be a record mm-hmm. of whether they're actually pulling over people appropriately. And so traffic enforcement, narcotics enforcement, gun enforcement, the proactive policing principles, the consent decree doesn't prohibit any of that. It's just required that they do it constitutionally. And that comes with good training, and that's why the police department, I believe, is on the cusp of compliance with the consent decree. I think there's a strong likelihood that we could be termed to be in substantial compliance with the consent decree before the end of the year. So the police department is doing things the right way, and the state police are doing things the right way. And they're doing things very strategically, very intentionally, and that is being reflected in the declining crime rate that we've been enjoying for the last 2+ years.
It is the Metropolitan Crime Commission, and when it comes to permitless carry, it became state law July 4th, I think it is, in Orleans Parish August 1st. Has that really been a non-factor, or what effect has it had on crime at all?
Well, so in the French Quarter, they have compensated, in the 8th District, they've compensated from losing that tool. And I talked about in the earlier segment that police department is doing much more narcotics enforcement, mm-hmm. and that includes in the French Quarter. So what the 8th District French Quarter area is doing is they're relying on technology. There's a rather robust camera system in the CBD French Quarter area, and the police and the state police are using those cameras to identify drug dealers, and then they're going in and arresting those drug dealers. When they arrest those drug dealers, they're recovering weapons. So, again, what constitutional carry took away, the law enforcement is utilizing other strategies to compensate for that.
But for those that were saying it was going to be Dodge City and this and that and the other thing, has there been any uptick in shootings or anything else?
No, and I think in large part because law enforcement has been doubling. The people that are most likely to be committing those crimes mm-hmm. are the people that have extensive criminal histories. And if you're a drug dealer and you're dealing drugs and you have a gun on you and you're in the French Quarter and you're not taken off the streets, there's a good chance something's going to go wrong, and if it does, and they open fire, that's when, you know, tragedies happen.
Let me get to this
so
real quick.
Police are pivoting.
Only have a minute left. Missy Wilkinson got a story at NOLA.com about city's jail being packed. Some are saying the reason that crime is down is because the jail is packed. Thoughts in 35 seconds?
Right. So the police have been arresting the right people, and that's being reflected because about 2/3 of the people that are in pretrial custody are in there for felony crimes of violence or felony weapons offenses. The other 1/3 are going to be in there for their criminal histories that have extensive arrest and conviction backgrounds, and those people are the worst of the worst in the city, and crime would not be as low were it not for those people being behind bars.
Thank you, Raf. You'll have a great week. Appreciate your information. As always, we'll take a break, come back, talk to Richard Nelson, Secretary of Revenue for Louisiana, about his plan to revamp the state's tax code. It is 9:09, 9:10 now. We're getting ready to talk about revamping the state's tax code, and I think everybody could be for that. Things like maybe make it like a flat tax, but then you start saying, well, in order to pay for that, we're going to have to do away with this and do away with that. And that's when people start saying, now, hold on. Ain't nobody talked about that. With that, we welcome in Richard Nelson, Secretary of Revenue for Louisiana. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Tommy.
Tell me about the hearing that happened last Wednesday. What was the purpose behind it, and what did it reveal?
Sure. So we had a joint meeting of the tax committees of the Senate and the House last Wednesday. And it was focused a lot on kind of the corporate side of the House. So corporate income, corporate incentives. I mean, that was a lot of the discussion. But really, that's part of the focus of this is not just on individual taxes, but also, you know, how do we make Louisiana more attractive to business? How do we get more investment in the state so that, you know, people have better jobs and more opportunity here? So our kids don't have to move to Texas to get a good job. They can stay here and, you know, continue to grow. And that was the focus mostly of that meeting. And I gave a little bit of a overview of our overall, you know, kind of tax plan direction as well. So, but it was to keep, you know, kind of get feedback from the legislature, give them an opportunity to, you know, voice whatever concerns they have or what goals they have with tax reform, because it's obviously a big challenge that Louisiana struggled with for a long time, but it's also a big opportunity.
You're an interesting guy. You're a biological engineer. Then you went to law school. Then you worked in security for the country, right?
Yeah, I spent 7 years in the Foreign Service of the State Department. So I lived and worked all over the world.
So how did you wind up from that being the guy that's going to try to revamp the state's tax code? I'm just curious about that, Richard.
Sure. So, I was in the State Department, and we were moving all over the world as diplomats. But I always followed the news back home in Louisiana, and mm-hmm. I got tired of always finding, you know, the headlines are always bad. We're always 50th in, you know, 50th at everything, or always at the bottom of the list. And I wanted to come home and raise my kids here in Louisiana. And when we came back, I told my wife I was going to try and fix things. So I ran for the legislature. I spent, you know, 4 years in the House of Representatives, and then I actually ran for governor last year, and then the Governor Landry was gracious enough to make me Secretary of Revenue to try and fix all these problems since I've been talking about them so much.
Well, let me tell you why I brought that up, because you seem like a guy that could live wherever you wanted, right, and make a living wherever you wanted. Accurate?
Yes, I mean, I was.
So why Louisiana?
Well, I'm from here. This is my home. I feel like if we don't fight to make it better, nobody else will. Unfortunately, many of the people I went to high school with, many of the people that I went to, LSU with, where I got my engineering degree, they're gone. I mean, they moved to Houston, or they moved to, you know, Florida, Virginia. They moved all over the country, and it wasn't voluntary. It's they moved there because they had better jobs and more opportunity, and that's why they went. And so I really think that if we fix the problems in Louisiana, we can outcompete all these other states. But the tax code is one of those major things that's holding us back, and it's been holding us back for 100 years, and we just haven't had the political will to make the big changes we need.
The reason I wanted to bring all that up, Richard, was I don't know you personally, but from the little bit we've spoken, I sense that you're a guy that you're not in it for the political power of it. You are legitimately of the generation and of the mindset to try to make the state better because you love it. And I commend you for that. That being said, how do you navigate your way through the politics of all of this to revamp the tax code? How do you even begin to go about it?
Sure. So, you know, I think that in the past, we've tried to kind of nibble around the edges of, you know, let's look at one credit or one exemption or one little piece of it, and let's try to fix that problem. And the problem with that is that, you know, there's always some special interest that's really invested in each individual piece, and the payoff for the people in general is not that much. And so the difference between what's been tried before and what we're attempting to do now is we're really trying to take a comprehensive look at it. Like, let's look at sales tax. Let's look at personal income tax. Let's look at the hundreds of exemptions and credits and incentives that we give out, and let's try and cut all those down and really just make it a fair playing field for everybody with low rates so that we can attract business, so that we can keep people here, so that we can give everybody an income tax cut. And that's what we're trying to do. So I think that comprehensive view, I think it gives everybody some a really good payoff in the end, because they get lower rates and they get to keep more of their money. And then at the other, on the other side of it is everybody gives up a little bit. So you might give up your own, you know, personal exemption or your own, you know, credit or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, everybody's going to be better off by having a more competitive tax code that's going to attract business here, that's going to, you know, create a future where your kids can get a good job here in Louisiana and the state will grow, instead of what we've seen, which is this kind of continuous out-migration. You know, we lost 80,000 people or so in the last 2 years. And so we have to really reverse that, and you can't do that with a broken tax code.
Who gets the majority of the credits when it comes to tax exemptions, et cetera, tax credits?
It's really all over the board. I mean, there's 223 exemptions to the sales tax. So there's, you know, that's 223 line items that, you know, this tax and this is taxed in some parishes and it's not taxed in others. We have a very complex sales tax code, so it's difficult for businesses to comply with. It causes all kinds of other problems. And then you have on the corporate side, you have a lot of different incentives and credits that, you know, what I say is it's kind of like going to the car dealer, right? You have a sticker price in Louisiana on the window that's really high. Mm-hmm. And if you get all these coupons and credits, then you end up having a relatively low rate. But most companies don't want to play that game. They just want to have a low rate so they don't have to go and hire a lobbyist or go hire some consultant to help them, you know, solve those puzzles. They just want to be able to say, this is what I'm going to pay. Okay. It's kind of like how everybody else feels too. And so the idea is to match what the price that people actually pay, match that to what is on the window, on the sticker, so that we can attract business, so we can keep them here. And that's, you know, really fixing that complexity problem is really what Louisiana needs. Because on the whole, our tax burden is lower than Texas, but nobody knows that because our, you know, the price on the window is so high, right? And so if we had it actually match, I think we'd be able to attract much more business. Many more people would rather be here when they know that they're actually paying less.
What is it going to take for me to put you in this state today? I'm just kidding. We're talking to Richard Nelson, the Secretary of Revenue for Louisiana, about revamping the state's tax code, and that's what they tell you at the dealership all the time. What's it going to take for me to put you in this car today? And I guess, Richard, when it comes to, I don't know, do you look at it from a cost-benefit standpoint of what return do you get on the exemptions or the credits, and what kind of jobs do they provide in return? Or do you look at it as you get rid of everything and you start from scratch? How do you even go about solving this Rubik's Cube?
So what we've really done is looked at other states that have done this successfully. North Carolina is a great example, Arizona, where they've really noticed that they need to have a more competitive tax code. Mm-hmm. And so they've gone through and they said, well, how can we change this? And it's generally focused on the same thing, is how do you broaden the base of the tax and lower the rates for everybody? And, you know, we've gone, or we're in the process of going through that exercise of working with the legislature of saying, well, you know, which things can we get rid of, which things have a policy reason for being there. And so we've tried to look at what other states have done. And honestly, we're just looking at a lot of the, you know, we've had studies and commissions, and everybody for the last 50 years have said Louisiana's tax code is broken and here's how to fix it. And what we've lacked is the political will to actually get it done. And so we're not really reinventing the wheel here. We're trying to build on what's already been done and all the work that's been done in Louisiana and outside of it, and just trying to put those ideas into practice, because it's not rocket science. It's just a difficult political battle. And I think right now we're in a situation where, you know, Governor Landry is very motivated to make Louisiana better, to grow the state. And so he's willing to, you know, to go to battle to make that happen. I think that both houses of the legislature are on board and in doing big things and swinging for the fences. They all got elected saying that they're going to grow the state and fix these problems that have been around for forever. So I think we're in a good position, a better position than we ever have been, to really do big things. But that doesn't mean the path is going to be easy, but I think we're in the best position we've ever been in.
So let me know if I'm making up stuff in my head or not, because I do. But if somebody is benefiting from the film credit and they have a job in that industry and you want to change that, they're saying, well, look at oil and gas. Look at what they get. But if somebody's working in oil and gas, they say, yeah, but we produce jobs, or we provide more bang for the buck from the state. And that's what they say to the people in the or the lobbyists in the film industry. How do you solve all of that? And is that a fair comparison or not?
Yes. I mean, I think it's true, is that if you cherry pick and you say, well, we're going to get rid of this credit, or we're going to reduce this incentive, then everybody else says, well, how come you're not going to reduce the other one? And so I think it's better to have a comprehensive view of it and just say, hey, look, this is just, we're going to do business a different way, where we're going to lower rates for everybody so that everybody will be paying a lower tax rate. And then it's not the state picking winners and losers in different industries. It's just making the whole system more competitive, easier to administer, and, I think better at attracting outside business, and even, giving an incentive for the businesses that are here to grow. That's really the rub, is that you're trying to make it where the state is not picking the winners and losers, that you're making it that it's a broad approach.
Everything right?
Yeah, no, it sounds like we're having a fire alarm or something like that. Sorry about that.
Well, do you need to get out the building or not?
No, it's okay. It's like it's just a drill.
Richard, we've traced the calls. They're coming from inside of the house. Get out of the house. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, all right? Because what you're saying makes perfect sense. But, of course, the question then is, well, who would be opposed to this if it makes so much sense? And I would guess the answer is a lot of people. And we'll find out about how you would actually go about fixing this. And we'll talk about Bitcoin as well, because I believe they're saying now that you can pay your taxes in the state in Bitcoin. Richard Nelson, our guest, smart guy, Secretary of Revenue for Louisiana. If you got any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. I'd love to pass them along for you. That's the Oakman Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line. I'm Tommy Tucker, back in a flash on WWL. 9:26 now, talking to Richard Nelson, Secretary of Revenue, about revamping the state's tax code. Let me get to this text, if I can, Richard, and it says, you want to lower taxes to help the state, but to help the state, more money needs to be allocated to education and health. Will this plan help to meet this need? I am not in education or health services.
No, sure, I'm here. So, I mean, I think that, on education, I think it's an interesting thing, because I think Louisiana spends actually about 20% more per pupil than any of our southern neighbor states. So we actually spend a lot of money in education. It's just not I don't know that we spend it as wisely as it could possibly
be.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't think that education really is a funding problem. It's more of a spending problem. And then on health, too, I mean, so we've done the Medicaid expansion under the previous governor, John Bel Edwards. And so we actually spend more on health care than I think any of our neighboring states per person as well, because most of our fellow southern states haven't expanded Medicaid. So we actually spend a significant amount of money on these things. I'll just tell you that it seems like the results aren't there. And I'll bring that back around in that I really think economic opportunity is the way to fix a lot of these problems, because, if people have more money, if they're able to get more in their paychecks, you'll end up with better healthcare outcomes, better educational outcomes, lower crime. I think if you look anywhere in the world or anywhere in the country, that's how it works. And so you can't fix it. It's very difficult to fix a lot of these problems by themselves. But I think if you give people the opportunity to have better jobs and, earn more money, you really end up solving a lot of these problems.
So where does that opportunity come from?
Well, so like I said, I think that fixing the tax code is what brings businesses here, is what will help businesses grow here in Louisiana, and that's what gives you better job opportunities. And those job opportunities are what is going to fund people having better healthcare outcomes, better educational outcomes for their kids. If people have degrees, if people have a higher socioeconomic status, the kids do better in school. I mean, that's just the way it works. And so and I think crime too is one of those things. If you're a really poor state, it's going to be tough to have a very low level of crime when you're a very poor state. And so I think growing the state and making it so that everybody is better off economically solves a lot of these problems just across the board. And I think the tax code is one of those things that's really been holding Louisiana back as far as attracting that business and opportunity here.
So if that makes every bit of sense, who could be against this and why? What's the opposition saying?
Sure. So, I my original tax plan in the legislature when I first got elected, I think the advocate called it the plan that had something everyone can hate. And
you're probably on to something if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that's true. But at the end of the day, the other side of that is that it has something everybody can love, right? So everybody's going to love lower income tax rates. Everybody's going to love a simpler system that's easier to comply with, that's easier to administer, and it's more predictable. I think that there's a lot of things for everybody to love. There's everybody will have to give up something in exchange for that. Out of the 223 sales tax exemptions, if it's one thing that, impacts you directly, that's going to be something you don't like. But the other 220 things that you're paying tax on, I think that will balance out. And so, I think overall, it's looking at it comprehensively gives everybody the opportunity to win, which I think makes it a more likely to succeed, and also what makes the goal so much better. The juice is worth the squeeze when you're going to have, much lower rates. You're going to have a state that's much more competitive instead of trying to take a little bit at a time approach where we're trying to fix, tiny little things around the edges. This is a swing for the fences. Let's try and fix everything so that, we don't have to keep talking about this for the next 100 years.
So let's talk about the 0.45 cents on every dollar sales tax that's set to expire. How does that play in all of this?
Yeah, so that 0.45 was passed, I think, in 2018 or so, and it was supposed to be a temporary tax so that we could bridge and come up with some kind of comprehensive tax change, right? And that's really what we're pushing, is to say, okay, that 0.45 was put in place to bridge us to some place where we need to be, and that expiration, which is going to happen next year on July 1st, if we don't do anything, would that's really provided us the opportunity right now to say, hey, look, we're going to have a, $500 million or $540 million shortfall from that expiring. And so why don't we figure out how to do comprehensive tax reform? Let's lower everybody's income tax rates. Let's restructure our tax code. Let's get rid of some of these exemptions that have kind of plagued us for forever. And if we do all those things, then the 0.45 becomes, it becomes less of an issue. We can basically maintain that 0.45, which is really not out of whack with what other states charge, and then instead fix all these other problems in our tax code, which was the original intention to begin with.
Let's talk about, I don't know if it's Hollywood South, the film industry or whatever. I'm reading Tyler Bridges' article here. It says, program cost the state $150 million last year, produced a return on investment of only 11 cents in state tax revenue for every dollar given away, according to your revenue department, Richard Nelson. But how does that fit into the whole economic picture of jobs, et cetera?
Sure. So, I don't want to pick on the film industry specifically.
Well, I'm just using it as an example. That's all.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I really, the returns on almost all of our incentive programs are pretty low. Like, it's the same, you lose 90 cents for every dollar you put into it from a state fiscal perspective, right?
But we'll interrupt you for a second. From the economic standpoint, at that instant, you're talking about basically subsidized jobs, right? Just once removed? Yeah, no?
Yeah, so I think that, for the film industry or for the film credit specifically, we give about $180 million a year of a program, mm-hmm. and it makes about 10,000 jobs, which comes out to about $17,000 a job or something like that the state taxpayers pay into the industry. Mm-hmm. I think the idea is that if we do some of these broader tax reforms, if we say, hey, let's just have a lower rate overall, let's not cherry pick individual pieces. And, it doesn't mean that we have to get rid of the whole program. Maybe we just have to, put some more restrictions on it, figure out how to get the taxpayers the biggest bang for their buck across all of the incentive programs. I think that is the goal of just making sure that the taxpayers get the best return on investment that they can. And so, and part of that is lowering the rates so that everybody has a benefit. And that's really the direction that I think we're moving in.
Do you really think there's a political will to get this done in Baton Rouge?
I think there is. I mean, I think that everybody sees the writing on the wall of we can't continue to lose, 40,000 people a year. You know, when I was running for governor, one of the things I said all the time was that the last time Louisiana added a congressional seat, which is the last time we actually grew faster than the rest of the country, was 1910, right? So, you know, it was a long time ago that Louisiana actually was growing faster than the rest of the country. And that's something that we, you know, we need to turn that around if we want the state to compete, if we want our kids to stay here. And it's going to take big changes in order to do that. And I don't know that there's anything that's more impactful as far as changing that climate than the tax code, because that has really been broken for over 100 years. It really goes back to Huey Long. And he kind of set up this whole system where, you know, you have to hire a lobbyist. You got to be some kind of special interest to get your break, or else you're not going to succeed in Louisiana. And I mean, I think that's the culture, that's the perception around the country of what doing business in Louisiana means, is that you have to play all these games. And that's the problem that we've been facing for a very long time. And until you throw that out, we're not going to have the success that I think all of us are looking for in Louisiana. And honestly, based on all the resources and everything that we have here, we should, you know, we deserve way more. I mean, we don't deserve to be average. We deserve to be in the top 10 instead of always at the bottom.
I agree with what you're saying, but I just know that when the legislative session starts, those phones are going to start ringing, and I don't – you think this is going to happen?
I think it's going to happen. I mean, I'll tell you, I'm more hopeful now than I've ever been. I'll tell you, it's very difficult. That's why it hasn't been changed in the last 100 years. But I think that it's something that we have to do. If we want our kids to, you know, if we want our kids to be able to grow up here and be successful and raise their families here, then we're going to have to change things. We can't keep doing what we're doing because it's obviously not working, and it is something that we really are going to have to take a big swing at, or else, you know, things aren't going to change.
Let me get the Bitcoin real quick, because I don't understand it. Honestly, Richard, I don't. And it seems like a scam to me. But yet the state's going to start accepting it, right?
So, yes. So the Department of Revenue especially has we just renegotiated. We negotiated a new contract to we're going to accept Bitcoin. We also lowered the transaction fees for people when they pay their taxes with a credit card or debit card. Mm-hmm. And so starting January 1st of next year, we should have our new contract in place so that we will accept Bitcoin for your tax liability.
And there's no way the state gets stuck holding the bag of something that's not worth anything? And again, I'm ignorant when I ask this because I don't understand a lot about it, but
no, so we use a third party vendor, so they basically exchange it on the spot. We get paid in dollars. So you take your Bitcoin, and then they exchange it, and then when we get the transaction comes through, we actually get dollars. We don't hold on to the Bitcoin.
That makes sense to me. All right. Thank you, Richard. I appreciate your time. I hope we get to talk to you again as this proceeds. I hope you make some progress. But, again, my name's Thomas. I'll believe it when I see it.
I believe you. I hear you. No worries.
Thank you, Richard. You bet. 9:44, 16 till 10, joined by our friend Katie Moore. Haven't spoken to Katie in a while, WWL Louisiana reporter and anchor. How are you, Katie?
Hey, Tommy, how are you? I'm doing well.
How's the fam? Everybody good?
Fam's good, although, you know, of course we don't want another hurricane, so we're just kind of, you know, watching the forecast closely over the next couple of days and hoping.
Your buddy Peyton told me that it should be a Florida thing, and which, of course, we don't want to wish on anybody, and a lot of people here own property in that area, but he said maybe a Category 3 heading into the panhandle.
Yeah, it's a lot. So I hope he's right. He's right a lot. So
he is right a lot, and it seems odd to hear your voice and not be lying on a couch, but, you know, that's the way I watch the news. Let's talk about your story with the what is going on here. Give me the whole context of this, Katie, if you would, please.
Okay, so apparently there is a building that is planned for Huey P. Long Avenue in Gretna. It's a building that is going to be on parish land in Jefferson Parish, and apparently there are some concerns raised by the Jefferson Parish Office of Inspector General. The Inspector General issued a public letter last week raising questions about plans for the building, how it was being funded, and the lease of the building, because apparently this building is being built and is going to be leased to Port Orleans Brewing Company for a brewery and a taco restaurant. In addition, there's going to be a kiosk that has parish information and city information in Gretna, a little coffee shop. So there is what they would consider a public use portion of this building. Mm-hmm. But largely, this building is being built to house a brewery and a taco restaurant. And so I think there are some questions about, number one, whether or not that is an appropriate use of public and taxpayer funds. And number two, the process in how this has been built. There are two companies that were created. One is a public benefit corporation, and one of them is an economic development corporation. This gets a little complicated, but
I'm going to slow you down a little bit because we don't have charts and graphs and all of that stuff. But so let's go back yeah. to the beginning. So this entity decides that they want to build this restaurant. Is that it?
These two corporations that were created back in the year 2000, they were created to build that parking garage that's next to the Jefferson Parish government complex.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yes.
That parking garage right there?
Right.
Yeah, anytime you have to go to court or you have any kind of business in Jefferson Parish government on the West Bank, you park in this parking garage. These two companies were created to build and manage that parking garage. And now, you know, fast forward to now, those two companies are being used to do other things.
Okay.
One of the concerns the IG has is that by using those companies, they may not have to follow public bid laws and such. So they feel like this is kind of a way to dole out taxpayer money without having to follow the public process that's tied to those dollars.
Who decided to use that company that built the parking lot instead of going through the normal process when they decided to build this port brewery, taco restaurant, public kiosk, whatever is going to be in there?
Yeah. So the Jefferson Parish Council has signed off on this. They've voted on it a number of times. That's one of the points that the supporters of this project will say when you talk to them about it and ask them questions about it. They say the Jefferson Parish Council has held 5 votes on moving this project forward, including one at a special council meeting that they called last fall, mm-hmm. In order to sign off on the lease agreement for this building that hasn't been built yet. So they held a special council meeting. It got pretty heated and fiery between council members, but it's basically been a Jefferson Parish Council decision on using this money, sending it to these two companies to build this taco restaurant and brewery in downtown Gretna.
So,
and I think one of the IG's biggest concerns is that the revenue doesn't ever flow back to Jefferson Parish. At least that's her concern. The way that this is established now, she's concerned that the money, even tax dollars, end up going to the city of Gretna, not Jefferson Parish. But Jefferson Parish is sending the lion's share of money to build the building and maintain it.
Say that part again just now.
So the tax dollars that will come from the brewery sales and the restaurant sales, it's in the city of Gretna. Mm-hmm. So the city of Gretna gets the tax revenue from this building, from whatever is in the building after Jefferson Parish builds it. Mm-hmm. So you have no tax dollars going back to the parish. You have tax dollars going to the city of Gretna and to the state, but not to the parish. And the parish is where the money's coming from to build it on parish land.
Let me say this. I'm no Katie Moore, okay? But it seems to me that, no, I mean that with all due respect, seriously, but at some point it would seem as though throughout these 5 council meetings, either the inspector general would have brought this up, or maybe the council would have noticed it, or somebody actually did somebody finally read the entire agreement? Katie, tell me what happened here. How did this?
Yeah, it's been piecemeal, so it's been kind of approved piece by piece as it's worked its way through the process. And these corporations that have been created to handle projects like this are not unique to this situation. They are in, you know, New Orleans as well. New Orleans has several of them as well. They're kind of used so that they can do things more efficiently than government can without, you know, the red tape. So that's what they're created for, in order to spur a lot of times economic development. And so I think as this has moved through the process, You know, I think a lot of the people involved were thinking, you know, this may be just a way to spur economic development in Gretna, which is obviously a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as it's been going through, the questions started getting raised as they got into the details. Devil always in the details. Yeah. And I think that's where we are in the process. And that's why the IG is raising sounding the alarm about this. Now, this wasn't a report. This was just a public letter that the IG issued. She's planning on doing a full audit and report, but she hasn't done that yet. So this public letter doesn't even take into account the opinions of everybody who's involved in this process. It's purely based on her research.
So what happens from here, Katie?
I think she's going to start really digging into how this project came about, continuing to ask questions about whether or not this is the best use of taxpayer dollars. I think one of the other things that, you know, she said to me when we were talking about this was that she's concerned that she doesn't want another Jefferson Performing Arts Center situation where that project lingered forever. They feel like in some cases it didn't meet the needs of the taxpayers. The market didn't bear out what they were hoping the Performing Arts Center would do, and it ended up ballooning in cost. I think that's her main concern here in raising these questions. So she's planning to do a full audit and a full report, which takes into account, you know, all the opinions of everybody who's been involved in the process. So I think there are a lot of questions to be asked, and I think, you know, that's her goal.
So who is at odds with the IG at this point?
You know, I don't know if anybody's necessarily at odds with her. I think, you know, supporters of the project feel like it's perfectly legit. It's on the up and up. They're excited to have this brewery, which, you know, everybody's a big fan of Port Orleans. I think, you know, that it's been a great asset to New Orleans. So I think, you know, the supporters of this project are the ones who are like, hey, we really want to get this moving forward. But the IG's just kind of saying, wait a second, we need to ask some more questions here.
Are you a beer gal, Katie, or not? I'm just curious.
I mean, I like a micro brew now and again.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm a big fan of Gnarly Barley up in Hammond. They're great. Of course, I love some Abita. Port Orleans is great, you know. Like, we have some great ones here.
Yeah.
So I think all of us like beer.
Beer or Mommy's Calm Down Juice, wine?
I mean, I'm a wine drinker normally, but I'll take a good micro brew now and again.
I'd just like to end it on a lighter note. I respect you and your work, Katie. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Anytime, Tommy.
Okay, see ya. 9:54, we'll take a break, find out what Noel's got coming up next on WWL.